Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And welcome back to another edition of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Ye.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are coming at you in the middle of the month of July 2019 to talk about our June 2019 book club pick, Kafka on the Shore by Haruki Murakami. We got Murakami, pretty much.
What does that mean?
It means that we delayed our conversation.
That is true. We've been delaying it for quite a while, but not because we wanted to, more like scheduling happened. And then I was just like, I don't really know how to discuss this book, Marvin. I think I need like some extra time. And you gave me extra time. And I still don't know how to talk about this book.
I mean, how do you know it's not something metaphysical happening to cause us to serendipitously reschedule this recording to discuss this book?
I don't believe
for a couple
in fate
weeks
or prophecy, whatever.
But yeah, so thank you everyone who have been waiting ever so patiently for us to talk about this book. We'll do our best, but yeah, since we've kept you waiting for so long, let's just dive right into it. Reba, why don't you start us off on discussing this book?
Should I start off with the description of the book for people who do not care about spoilers and are just jumping into this episode?
Yeah, I guess we should put up our standard spoiler warning. We will be talking about this book in its entirety and trying to figure this shit out. So spoilers abound. If you haven't read Kafka on the Shore by Haruki Murakami and don't want to get spoiled, now is your chance to stop the recording and go in and read the book. Though I have a feeling, even if you listen to us before you start, you're still going to get something out of it.
Some people just like to have like knowledge before they jump in. They don't read Murakami books cold like we do.
That's true.
Okay, so the description of the book. Kafka Tamura runs away from home at 15 under the shadow of his father's dark prophecy. The aging Nakata, tracker of lost cats who never recovered from a bizarre childhood affliction, finds his pleasantly simplified life suddenly turned upside down. As their parallel odysseys unravel, cats converse with people, fish tumble from the sky, a ghost-like pimp deploys a heagle-spouting girl of the night, a forest harbors soldiers apparently unaged since World War II. There is a savage killing, but the identity of both victim and killer is a riddle, one of many which combine to create an elegant and dreamlike masterpiece. Wow, I really should have read the book description, like the book jacket, before I started reading, because wow, it reveals a lot more than I expected.
I mean, it's kind of like the greatest hits, like it's the clip show of this book saying, here's all the weird shit you're going to see.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would affect your enjoyment of it, though.
That's true. I don't know.
Like if you knew there was a pimp coming up, or if you knew there was rain falling from the sky, or even cats talking to people,
or like a murder.
Yeah,
because I did not know that this would turn into like a murder mystery. I mean, it was definitely like, it didn't feel like a crime novel, but it was definitely like there were a lot of questions around the murder of Kafka's father.
Yeah,
and just the identity of Kafka's dad. I was like, I was just like, who is he? Like, he's definitely not Johnny Walker. Like, it seemed really weird, but anyway, I guess we can just start off with This was our first Murakami book. We went in cold.
Yeah.
We have heard some things about Murakami's writing style, especially since we read books before that have been influenced by his style, like Rainbirds by Clarissa Gonawan and Bangkok Wakes to Rain.
Yeah.
And I can kind of see the similarities, like you kind of tie in different storylines and different characters doing totally different things,
but right.
somehow, like, as you read on, they're all connected.
And, like, the descriptions of, like, mundane actions and details and pop culture in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I can see, like, how all three have, like, the style of being mood pieces. It's more about, like, how, like, the atmosphere of a place and, like, the feelings of a character rather than being plot-driven.
Right. So, I know from experience on this book club that you typically don't like stories that are kind of, I don't know if open-ended is the right way to call it, but like don't wrap up, I guess.
I'm okay with open-ended endings. Mm. I think it's just like, from what I have read on Goodreads and also interviews, because I really did try to like make sense of everything after I finished reading. It just seems like Murakami readers, they are divided. You either really, really love his work or you kind of fall off in the middle of reading and you're just like, I don't know, like everything doesn't make sense. And they're like kind of hesitant to read a second book.
Right. So is this Murakami readers on this book specifically or Murakami people who read Murakami?
No, people read who read Murakami.
Right.
And I feel like I'm more of like the latter. Like I was so confused while I was reading this book. And if I was not reading it for Books and Boba, I probably would have quit midway through.
Mm.
It took a lot out of me because I had to like reread parts again. And I was also listening to it on audiobook.
Right.
So I would technically reread things three times because I would read it and then I would listen to it and then I would go back to reading it. And it still didn't really quite make sense to me. And I wonder if that's just like the book, because I heard that like the Wind Up Bird Chronicle was similar with its kind of like dreamscape of a novel. Like it is more like surreal and it has magical realism, but there is more of a resolution and
right.
and things aren't as loosely tied. That's what I've kind of read from Goodreads reviews. So I don't know if it was just this book that I felt like that I was struggling to get through. How about you, Marvin?
I didn't have as much of a problem getting through it as it sounds like you did. I think at some point, I stopped trying to, because at first I was trying to like figure it out, you know, because the book mentions Chekhov's gun, like the trope of Chekhov's gun within the story. And I felt like everything I was reading was a Chekhov's gun, like everything was a barrel.
Yeah, right? Everything was like kind of like a red herring.
Right. But once I got over that
hurdle,
need to pay attention to everything and just let the story go, I felt like at the very least, the story, like, I was able to move along more quickly. Like, because like you mentioned, this book is something that Murakami recommends that you read multiple times.
Yes.
Right? And yeah. I don't know if the first go-through should be the most critical, because I think if you see this book as a riddle you need to solve, like, it's pretty dense, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, definitely the length was one of the main challenges for me. Because, like, I think in the beginning, Murakami's prose definitely grabbed me.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny because his prose is very simplistic, mm-hmm. whereas, like, his, like, the themes in his book and just kind of, like, the plot of the book is not simplistic at all.
Yeah.
So I am grateful for that because I was able to read things without, like, questioning it too much mm-hmm. on the prose and, like, what he means. But at the same time, like, I was just like, okay, like, I'm, like, 200 pages into the book. Normally, that's, like
yeah.
that's, like, the end of the second act for a lot of other books. But I was like, oh, my God, where is this going? Like,
well, I mean, there's dual storylines, right? There's one with Kafka and one with Nakata. And I feel like the Nakata storyline followed a more traditional path of like this is like a road trip story.
Yeah, it's like a road trip. There's like there's a quest and there's kind of like an urgency, mm-hmm. whereas with like Kafka's storyline, it was very like very slow, very meandering, and
it was kind of like, it reminded me of Rainbirds, where it was just a person going to this new town and just a lot of vignettes with different people,
like morning routines and stuff like that.
Yeah. So part of what like initially tripped me up, I guess, was trying to figure out what the link was between the two stories.
Yeah, I think the first link that kind of clicked for me was, well, I guess like the first hint was, I think it's either the second or third chapter, you read these military reports uh-huh. on the Hillside incident. And yeah. a group of children who are like mushroom picking, they kind of go into a coma for a short time, except for one boy. And he wakes up about like a week later without any memory.
Right.
And I immediately, like once Nakata was introduced, I was like, oh, that's him. That was like the first link. And then once like Nakata murdered Johnny Walker and Kafka, and then in the following chapter, like Kafka's like, oh, I dreamed about like my father mm-hmm. being killed. I was like, okay, like there is something going on here. I don't know if it's Nakata's spirit leaving and Kafka's spirit coming to possess Nakata. There's something supernatural about this. I don't really know where this book is going. Is it a dream? Is it not? Like, do we have like evil evil living spirits? It was like very, like you said, like I went into the book trying to figure out like what was the Chekhov gun, and like it's probably not the best way to go into reading this book.
I mean, when I was going through that segment, I kind of felt, because like as consumers of like high concept Japanese animes and video games, like we're no strangers to metaphysics as a storytelling like mechanic.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I thought it was kind of like, okay, maybe Nakata is a manifestation of Kafka's, like...
Yeah, that's what I thought,
like,
too.
For inner like, yeah. demons or something.
Well, like, from the get-go, I knew that the boy named Crow was, like, his superego. Or just, like, someone in... someone who kind of takes over when things get tough for Kafka, and he kind of needs, like, a...
Right, he's, like, the guiding, yeah.
It's like, you have to be the toughest 15-year-old.
Right. I love how... Well, I don't know if I love it. It was amusing. I guess it's the right word. How much time Murakami dedicates to reminding us how buff Kafka is.
Okay, so that is where like Murakami kind of is inspired by his own workout routine. Because okay. Murakami is...
Is he a big boy?
Yeah, he is a big boy. He works out alone. He has completed like 3 or 4 marathons. He does like a long distance swimming thing every year. And... Yeah, like Murakami, I have heard so many things about him without reading a single single book. Like, because writers revere him so much, especially his process. He started writing when he was 29, and he was inspired to write a novel because he went to a baseball game and the team that he was cheering for like hit like a home run, and he was like, ah, I can write a novel if that person can hit a home run. So he started writing his first novel right then and there.
I want to like read about the metaphysical journey of that home run and how that affected his.
Oh, I know, his right? Inner I'm sure it's like up there in a blog post. Anyway, he is revered a lot by writers because of his process, and his process is waking up at 4 a.m. in the morning, writing, working on his manuscript for maybe 5 or 6 hours. And then reading a different book or listening to music. And then he goes to sleep at 9 p.m. And he says that he does this every day. His routine has not changed in like 3 decades. And like that takes dedication. But also like, is he a robot? Like, is he an anime character? like who does this? So you can kind of see that in Kafka, who's like, oh, I'm going to work out. Right. And get buff because I am the toughest 15-year-old. And
yeah. But you also see like he still sees the world like a 15-year-old. He all of his actions he kind of blames on other people, right?
I don't know if he blames it on other people. It's more like he believes in like fate. Like there is like because like his father tells him, oh, you're going to sleep with your mom and your sister,
right,
and you're going to kill your father, who's me. And it's like he believes in this kind of prophecy, and he's like so determined to escape from it, but also at the same time he's like, oh, like this is the only thing I can do, this is my clear path,
which is
kind of really weird. But
it's also a very teen thing, right? It's like, you know, your typical Asian upbringing where you're told be a doctor, be an engineer, and you're kind of resigned to doing that, even though it's might not be something that you want, but you think this is the only way to live.
Yeah.
Right? Like kind of that trapping of like, as a kid, you're at the whims of adults.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. I definitely got that from reading it. And also it's just, in a way, it's like, oh, it's a terrible prophecy, but also it is easier to follow a set plan rather than like learn how to do things by yourself.
I mean, was this book just a giant retelling of Oedipus?
I don't know if it was a retelling of Oedipus. Yeah.
I mean, what did you think about all the Oedipal stuff?
I'm sure it's a commentary on like how, like in our dreams, in our imagination, like all of the dark desires that we don't even dare to say out loud kind of like come true. Because a lot of the gory scenes in this novel, it was so visceral and disgusting. And same thing with like all the sex scenes too. It seemed really like gratuitous and graphic in a way where I honestly wanted to skip through it all. But
yeah, that cat scene was pretty,
that was rough.
Yeah. And yeah, like there are descriptions of like rape pretty much.
Yeah. Right. And that's like also interesting because in that moment, Kafka is like, I know this is wrong. Like after he wakes up from the rape dream.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, well, like I know this isn't real. Like, I know I didn't rape her in real life, and I know that she's not my sister in real life. But that's what I thought when I was dreaming of her. And like, it brings up the question of like, okay, well, is he still responsible for that rape if it didn't happen in real life? Like, yeah. is it still considered like a crime when it's just in your head? And then also it brings into question like us as readers, because it's like, oh, we witnessed this happening, so we're kind of complicit in it as well. So it's a lot of like ethical questions that come up with dreams and responsibility, and there's also like a mention of one of the Holocaust administrators, and how like he didn't technically kill, like physically kill someone, but his plans, his imagination to create like this this horrible death process, it's the thing that made it possible. So that's kind of brought in as an example as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of philosophy in this book, and like that always like really turns me off when I'm reading. there were times when I had to put down the book and I just kind of like looked at Dan and I said, I think I'm too stupid to understand the contents of this book. Like, I know this book is trying to tell me something, but at the same time, like, I feel like I'm at the fringes of, like, all of the philosophy that it's trying to teach me.
I mean, I think parts of the book, I do feel like it's kind of showing off, like, how smart I am. Look at how smart I am. But at the same time, I feel like in the same way that, like, those high concept animes kind of do, like, they also try to explain it to you. There are definitely, like, exposition dumps within the book. Like the character of Colonel Sanders, who is
a concept, by the way.
Yeah.
He's not God. He's not a demon. He is a concept.
But like him explaining that is kind of the book trying to tell you, yeah, like don't, like this is how you should read me as, right? This is what we're talking about.
Everything is a metaphor in this book.
Yeah.
And they say it as much in the beginning of the book, and how like Kafka's relationship with Misaiki and Sakura, like that is also a metaphor for his relationship with his mother and sister who have abandoned him.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, I get that part. But did he really have to, like, project that in, like, into those female characters? I don't know. Just like, oh, this could be my sister. And then he still has, like kind of, like, sexual, not intercourse, but, like, he has kind of, like,
desires.
Yeah. And I'm like, you're projecting this onto someone who isn't your sister, but, like, that's kind of, like, your kink.
But he's like a horny boy, you know? He's a very horny boy.
The sex scenes were just, I don't know. Like, I feel like those were not well written. Mm. And there was just so much penis. Like, there is so much description about his penis and I don't know. Like, the female characters in this book also really, like, did not sit well with me. Because it seems like the purpose of these female characters are just to be, like, vessels of desire for the male characters. And it's just like, okay, it's kind of like a weird version of a manic pixie dream girl where they're, like, there to change a man's life by just, like, having sex with them or, like, I don't know.
Yeah, our Goodreads member Lauren, she wrote into our Goodreads forum and she said that this is her second time reading the book and that the second time through, the shallowness of the female characters really stuck out to her this time. And it was actually kind of a turnoff.
I heard that is, like, a thing in Murakami books, mm-hmm. that a lot of his female characters are just kind of there for, like, sexual desire, or they're just there for exposition. They really don't have minds of their own. That is just, like, a generalization that I've seen in reviews.
Yeah, like, the female characters were definitely not as well developed. Even the trans character,
Oshima,
like, there was that scene where Oshima, like, would you call it a clapback?
Yeah,
like,
it's a clapback.
Yeah, to feminist advocates who were written. If there was a, like, character trait that, like, Murakami slapped on them, it was just shrill, right?
Yeah.
And I thought that chapter really bugged me. Like,
I remember, like, us talking about that for a while. I mean, it's been over a decade since this book has been translated.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it does show its age. And I kind of wish that, like, it wasn't two feminist advocates who are complaining about stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's
got to be a better way to... Because the whole point of that chapter is to show that Oshima is... Trans.
Is a gay trans man. Yeah. And also to show the narrow-mindedness of people and how, like, because Oshima kind of, like, tells Kafka, like, those people scare me the most. People who are so narrow-minded and aren't, like, willing to accept mistakes, mm-hmm. and look into how to grow. Because those are the people who... Like, if you look at our government now, like, those are the people in government, and the consequences of their actions are very, very severe.
I mean, not just our government, like, every government right now.
Yeah. Especially Japan. not much has changed.
Mm.
But, yeah, I just kind of wish that scene was not... written not at the expense of female characters, especially, like, I feel like I would have been okay with it if the female characters in the book, like Misayaki and, like, Sakura, had, like, more depth to them, like, more of, like, a personality to them.
Yeah,
they seem kind of really bland to me.
Well, they're very, like, they explain it that, you know, Misayaki had her soul taken away from her.
Yeah, Miss Saiki is all, they say that she's all memory,
mm-hmm.
because she kind of, like, stopped growing after her lover passed away in the war. Not the war, like, in a student protest.
Yeah, and Sakura is just manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a weird, weird way.
But at the same time, she was probably one of the most normal characters in the entire story, right?
Except for
the part where she's, like, jacking off.
Especially when she's like, she's like, I know you're 15 and I'm going to give you a hand job because it doesn't count as having sex while I, like, have my boyfriend. Okay. And then while she's like giving him a hand job, she says, "I wish I was your sister." And I'm like, "What? What? Like, like I don't want to kink shame, but like it was a weird moment for me, especially when I was on a plane on my red eye flight and I'm listening to this on audiobook and I'm just like, "Oh my god, like I can't." I was like, "This is a really weird and awkward scene." And speaking of awkward sex scenes, his relationship with Miss Saeki, like, was definitely the weirdest relationship in the entire book. Because, like, I don't
want to say I didn't expect it.
No, I totally expected it. But, like, it just see, because I didn't really understand, like, where the metaphysical stuff was. Because he was like, "Oh, I'm having sex with like, the 15-year-old girl that is trapped inside this woman's body." And I'm like, wait.
But still having sex with this, like.
So it's just like, I don't know. Because at some point he says, like, "Oh, like, I'm." Like, he kind of hints that he's like the lover who passed away and they're kind of like completing each other in this like sexual act. And I'm like, I don't understand. Like, is he like, is the spirit of her lover really like in him? Like, is this 15-year-old version of Miss Saeki like a specter? Like, it, like, I don't really quite understand. Is this a dream sex? Is this real sex?
I mean, if you look at this entire book as completely centered on Kafka, like, does it even matter what she is, right? Like, I think, like you said, like, the female characters in this story, Miss Saeki, Sakura, are there just to, like, play a part in his
awakening.
Yeah.
I think the part that really sat, like, unsettling with me was the scene where Miss Saeki is sleepwalking and he knows that she's not like fully awake and they still have sex anyway. And I'm like, that's rape. And that is not mentioned as like something wrong.
Yeah.
And that really, really unsettled me. Also, like a grown woman like having sex with a 15-year-old.
But he's buff.
Yeah. He's the toughest 15-year-old. Well, we've been talking a lot about Kafka, so we can talk more about Nakata.
Yeah. I guess, like, once I started seeing his story as separate from Kafka and not, like, intrinsically linked, I think I was able to, like, get with the flow a little bit better. Because it's really hard. Like, I don't know if it was the same for you, not to, like, read his story through, like, okay, what does this mean for Kafka right now?
Yeah. I definitely was searching for some kind of link and, you know,
but,
cause and effect.
I mean, I think with Nakata's story, that's where you get the most magical realism, right? Like his, like you say, his story was a quest. It was an adventure. And there are talking cats and weird brands come to life.
And fish falling from the sky and slugs and leeches blocking the freeway.
Yeah. I would probably read a book that's all Nakata's story.
Yeah, yeah. I found myself thinking the same exact thing. I wish it was more linked with Kafka. Like, more obviously linked, because then I would kind of read along being like, okay, this is going somewhere. Because, like I said before, Nakata's storyline has more urgency.
Yeah.
So it feels like things are moving towards something, like something is culminating into a big event. Whereas with Kafka's story, it's very much like more meandering. And even when he gets into deep within the forest and he finds that spirit village, I don't know how else to describe it, but he's in that spirit village. It still seemed really, like, it just seemed to plateau for me. I'm like, okay, he's here, but I don't know why he's here. And when he gets to leave, like, I don't quite understand. Like,
yeah.
Whereas with, like, Nakata, it's like, okay, like, he has this quest. He has to find the entrance stone. And, like, there is more of a thread.
Yeah, but at the same time, I was kind of thinking both of these characters are being led by something, right? Like, Nakata's actions aren't really his own. He's, like, following instructions pretty much.
Yeah.
Right. And almost just like, maybe not like similar to how Kafka is kind of just fulfilling his fate and prophecy or trying to like.
Yeah, there's a lot of like fate involved where people feel like this is the path that they're supposed to be in. And what did you think of like Nakata suddenly dying? Because I did not expect that. And I guess like that's the whole point. It's like, oh, you can't like you think that you have this destiny to carry out, but you really can't predict human nature.
Right.
And like I thought that was like a really funny moment when Nakata died and Hoshino is just like, I don't know what to do.
Well, I mean he dies the same time as Miss Saiki and it was right after their meeting.
Because they're talking about the entrance stone.
And, yeah.
You know, they talk about how Miss Saiki is only full of memories and there's only like half of her like left in her body. Because right. she just kind of stopped developing after the death of her lover. Whereas mm-hmm. Nakata, you know, he's kind of a shell as well. Like he has no memory and all of the potential he had in his youth, like that's all gone. So you have two people who are kind of tied to this entrance stone and they're just kind of half of a spirit left.
Like this world beyond where they, I guess, left a part of themselves.
Yeah. And then it's just like when they die, it's kind of a nice resolution because it's like, oh, they're going back to the place where the remaining part of their spirit is.
I mean, to answer your question, I don't know if I thought of anything. I was like, oh, okay. You know, like he's dead. I guess like his journey is fulfilled somehow. Because it was like, I don't know. I felt like, with Nakata's story, it felt like he was more a tool than a person. You know, and you did get his like inner monologue and how he sees the world. But his ultimate role in the story was to, I mean, not even make contact with Kafka, right? It was like to make contact with Miss Saiki.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like also how Hoshino, like, he follows Nakata, like, through this journey, being like, okay, well, he reminds me of my grandfather.
Yeah.
And then, like, as their journey progresses, he's just like, oh, man, like, my life has changed. The way that I look at things has changed because I'm with Nakata. And he thinks that he can stay with Nakata, like, pretty much forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then he dies. And it's just like, okay, well, you thought that this was destiny and this was your path, but obviously.
I mean, everything's a metaphor,
everything
right?
Everything is a metaphor.
That's a metaphor for, I guess, you know. I mean.
That's a metaphor for you can't expect, like, everything to go according to plan in life.
Or to be, like, be able to lead. I mean, part of it is, like, you can't be. Just as Nakata was being led by some unseen force, Hoshino was being led by Nakata. And, like, you can't be led all the time, right? I'm, like, just pulling this out of my butt because I feel like this book wants you to go up your own butt with, like, theories. But I guess the thesis or one of the theses of the book was, like, get out of your comfort zone, right? Like, because a lot of the characters are people who leave home.
Yeah.
And like experience things outside of what they're comfortable with, right? Like it starts with Kafka running away from home. Every single character in the story includes someone who's either run away from home or leaves for the first time or tries something new, like breaks their routine for the first time.
Yeah. Like stepping out of their own world for the first time. It really is a coming of age story if you just kind of strip all of the
ickiness,
all of the ickiness, all of the complex philosophy that's kind of thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
Like Labyrinth is something that is thrown around a lot in this book.
Because
like you have Kafka go venture into the forest and like he's kind of trying to figure out what to do in this forest until he finds the spirit village.
Yeah.
And later on you find out that like it's not him, it's not really the journey of him getting out of the forest that is the labyrinth. It's him, like him sorting through all of his like parental trauma and like this Oedipus complex, like that is his whole arc, I guess.
Yeah.
And like also just, you know, like it was a random thing that I noticed, but his dad also is kind of similar to Nakata and Miss Saiki, because he was struck by lightning and he's changed. And it's like, oh, like, is he one of those people whose spirit is kind of like left behind because of this affliction or because of this incident?
I mean, is that a metaphor for adulthood?
Oh, I don't know.
And how Japanese middle-aged people are shells of their former selves.
I feel like I'm a shell of my former self, and I'm not even 30 yet.
After reading this book.
I don't know. I felt like something left me when I was reading this book. Like, you know, like how like in anime, like you see like that spirit, like a ghost of like the character like leaving their body. That's kind of how I felt when I was reading this
book. Did that happen before or after the cat scene?
You mean like the cat dissection scene?
Yeah.
I think it was much later on when I started to kind of lose grasp with the reality of this book. Because like it was really disgusting to read the cat dissection scene, and it was just like, this is really weird and like creepy and gory, but I felt like it moved the plot along, if you can say there was a plot, because Kafka wakes up from like a short coma and like he finds blood on himself. So I was like, okay, I feel like there is a mystery of brewing. So I didn't feel really lost at the end of the first act / the beginning of act two. It was kind of when Kafka is just hiding out in the forest for the first time, where I was like, I'm slipping. I don't know. like I don't know what's happening. Because that's when all the sex stuff happens. And I was like, I don't know what's happening, man. This book is weird.
I mean, what are your thoughts on the Johnny Walker character? Do you think that was Kafka's father or like some sort of like demon man? Well, I mean, it was a demon man, for sure.
It was a demon man. And if you go with the logic of like, okay, there are like spirit possessions and people are moving back and forth between the spiritual world and this world and people are jumping consciousness, it could just be said that like a demon or an evil spirit or some part of his dad that is dark emerged, and that kind of like he came in the form of Johnny Walker. And I, like, when I first came across that scene where you meet Johnny Walker for the first time, I was just like, I kind of had to, like, reread it. I'm like, no, not that Johnny Walker, right?
I feel like it's, like, the scene from, like, the latest Ghostbusters with Kristen Wiig, where, like, the Ghostbusters logo comes to life. I was like, okay, is this just, like, a dude jumps out of a bottle?
A dude jumps out of a bottle.
Yeah. I mean, that... So, there's a chapter at the end of the novel that's not numbered, just called A Boy Named Crow. That chapter stuck out to me because that's... So, that's the chapter where the boy named Crow does battle with Johnny Walker in, like, the dreamscape.
Yeah. That part was really hard for me to read because I don't really do well with gore and violence.
Yeah.
And I was like, ugh. Like, eye sockets are being destroyed.
Well, I mean, that's how birds fight. I don't know, like, it felt like that character was written as if it was the big bad of the story. I mean, did you read anything that talked about that stuff
about Johnny Walker?
Yeah, the character Johnny Walker.
Well, the New Yorker said something about how, like, it's like a symbol of material desire and how like how that can be formed as something evil.
I mean,
that's why Murakami put it in the form of
a brand.
I'm not sure if I'm interpreting that correctly, but I can kind of see the logic behind it, you know? But that scene, that chapter, the boy named Crow with the epic battle, mm-hmm. like, I think that's the closest you can get to a resolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the closest you can get to, like, okay, like, something has been overcome. Like, something has, I don't know, like, you kind of see Kafka as someone who has grown up. Like, there's some kind of, like, resolution to his arc after he defeats this...
The manifestation of, like, his father, kind of, father. But also a demon.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm trying to remember his motivation. He was trying to create a flute out of cat's souls. I'm blanking on what he was going to do with that flute.
I can look it up. So there really isn't a reason for him to build these flutes. He just feels like it's his calling. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to read what he said in the chapter, Boy Named Crow. I made this flute out of the souls of cats I've collected, cut out the souls of cats while they were still alive and made them into this flute. I felt sorry for the cats, of course, cutting them up like that, but I couldn't help it. This flute is beyond any world's standards of good and evil, love or hatred. Making these flutes has been my longtime calling, and I've always done a decent job of fulfilling my role and doing my bit. So another, like, it's fate. This is what I am born to do.
And I'm also, I guess, yeah, like a cog in this capitalist system. If you go with the New Yorker's theory that he represents capitalism, then I guess...
Not just capitalism, but just like, you know...
Like adults' role in complicity, I guess, in the capitalist systems as a cog.
Yeah.
Like your role is to create this thing. It's not up to you whether it's used for good or evil. That's not your responsibility. Your responsibility is to make this thing, even if the process of making it is kind of violent.
Unethical.
Yeah, does violence to things. And I mean, I think in that case, I guess it does. It's interesting that he makes it out of cats, and that in this story he imbues the cats with personalities. Right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I guess some people might not have as much sympathy for like stray cats, but if you give them a name and a personality, then all of a sudden they're like people. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was what he was going for. That's my galaxy brain moment right now.
I think I remember someone saying in a review that it was a reference to another Japanese novel, I Am a Cat. I forgot the author's name, but like.
Yeah.
It's a reference to it. There's a lot of references in this book, and obviously I'm not well read enough to catch all of them.
Right. I just remember that there was another epic battle that happens after Nakata dies.
And, it's with Hoshino, right?
Yeah,
with
Hoshino like tries to close the entrance stone, and then this like blob monster comes out, right? Or some
yeah,
sort of
yeah.
like monstrosity.
Yeah.
Was that Johnny Walker, or was that...
There are theories about it being Johnny Walker / Kafka's father spirit. I don't know. But I thought that was like pretty it was pretty weird because all of the weapons that Hoshino uses, it's like completely useless.
He defeats him by smashing him with the entrance stone, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually I enjoyed Hoshino's character.
I think Hoshino was like the most dynamic character.
Yeah. I love that he developed an appreciation for classical music to the point where, like, something that people don't learn, like, when they hear classical music is every symphony or every recording is different because of how the conductor or how the people play it. And so, like, it was really fun to see him come to this realization that, like, he really likes this version of this Beethoven suite, but not this other version, and to be able to articulate that to people. It's like, wow, you learned culture. Yeah. Good job.
I learned a lot about Beethoven in this book.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's another one of Murakami's styles, right?
Yeah. He does write a lot about music, which is what I've heard. He actually wrote like a nonfiction book on classical music. He's like friends with this I don't know if they're a conductor or composer, but like he did kind of like an essay about him. Also, Haruki Murakami used to work at a record store when he was a teenager. And after he graduated from college, he opened up a jazz club and it was called the Peter Cat. Like, I think a Peter Cat or something. It had cat in the name.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a theme for him.
It seems like a theme for him.
Yeah. I guess I was expecting more or some reference to Schrodinger's cat for some reason, but I guess...
I mean, isn't that like kind of included in the book? I don't know. I felt like it.
With the whole dad thing, like,
yeah, with the whole dad thing, and also just like all of the dreams in the book is like, oh, did you really kill your father? Did you not kill your father? Like, did you really rape your sister? Did you really have sex with your mother? I don't know. It's a dream, right?
That's true. I mean, it reminds me of like dreams that I've had, like lucid dreams, where at some point you realize you're in a dream, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, so none of this matters, right? I've had a dream where I literally, like I think crashed my car or something. I was like, shit, like, I'll pay for all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, it's like, wait, this is a dream. I don't owe shit. I don't owe anything. I'm good.
So you just, like, ran around being like, I'm free. I'm free of capitalism. maybe that's why I, like, didn't really jibe with this book that is pretty much like a dream, just like a dreamscape of a novel. I don't really dream.
Really?
I don't. Usually when I sleep, I just kind of black out. I don't really remember. The only dreams I remember are nightmares. And
I mean, there's plenty of nightmares in this book too.
Yeah. I mean, my nightmares can be put into two different categories. One is like where I'm like really, really stressed out before I go to sleep. And then and in my dream, like everything goes wrong. It's like, oh, I like I'm late to a meeting and then I do like a presentation. But
then you realize the dream.
No, I never realize the dream. I don't realize it until I wake up. Oh, and then I'm terrible. Like, oh, fuck. Like, because you stress out that entire time and you don't know it's a dream. And then the other one is like supernatural stuff, because I'm afraid of ghosts and dolls, and a lot of supernatural things pop up in those types of dreams. So for those, I'm like, oh, this is a dream, but I also can't get out. So
that's terrifying.
Yeah. So I don't really dream. And Haruki Murakami, he actually said in an interview that he doesn't dream either. He writes. So all of his books are pretty much
his dreams. I can see that, I guess.
I feel like,
I mean, that's where
it's like Inception, man.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphysical aspects of his story definitely make more sense that way. If everything is like, if everything's a metaphor.
I know, like, Norwegian Wood is the only realistic novel. That is what people have been saying. Like, there are dream-like qualities to it, but it is like very linear and very, very, very different from all of his other books.
Yeah.
I am curious to read his other books. I haven't closed the door on Murakami yet, and I think that is quite an accomplishment for me.
I mean, it's interesting enough that, like, I am definitely curious on what other Murakami books read like. Are they all about horny 15-year-olds that are buff?
No, I actually heard that most of his characters are like in their 30s or adults. This was kind of like a change of pace for him.
Oh. That's good.
But I heard that one of the flaws of his novels is that characters kind of repeat themselves. So it's like, if you read one Murakami novel, you've kind of read like a whole bunch of other Murakami novels. Because characters seem similar, themes seem similar.
I mean, I guess what would there's so much of this book that we haven't talked about, but I feel like those are just details, like stuff like the military reports and what happened to Nakara And
actually, that fucking scene with the teacher beating the crap out of him because he like found like her sanitary pads with blood on it. I was like, oh, there's something really just terrible about men writing about women's periods. Because like the teacher's like, you don't understand. It's like the most embarrassing thing that can happen to a woman. And then before like the whole like period incident, she has like this very visceral dream about like having sex with her her ex-husband. And as she's like going on this field trip with the kids, she like her monologue says, like, oh, I can still feel him inside me. And I'm like, oh my God. Like,
so much pain in this story.
So much penis in the story. And like, I just, that was when I was like, oh, Murakami's not very good with writing female characters. Because if this is what he thinks that, thinks about women in general, he needs to do some digging. And like, yeah.
I feel like I was warned about that before coming in.
Yeah, we were warned, and I still wasn't prepared.
Yeah.
So wrapping up?
Yeah, I mean, there's still so much that we could be talking. I think we hit most of the big points. Like, I don't really have... Everything else would be, like, just pure speculation on what we think things meant.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if any of you have... But if any of you listening have any thoughts about either what we've talked about or things we haven't talked about, please let us know on the Goodreads forums. We'd love to hear what you think about this book, because I feel like this is the type of book where there's a lot of thoughts. And like you said, this Murakami is a very polarizing author.
Mm-hmm.
People love him or hate him. I would say there's no in between, but I feel like we're kind of in between.
Yeah, we're kind of in between, because I feel like you and I, like, because we have watched, because we have consumed so much media that is kind of similar in style, we kind of get what he's going for.
Yeah.
And it's like, just like, okay, I get what you're going for. I get why you're so like celebrated as an author.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not really like for me, it's not really something that I like really resonate with.
It wasn't like, I didn't feel like my mind or world was blown by reading this book, which I kind of like, I was kind of expecting, I guess, because of how highly people talk about him. But like, in terms of like what type of story this is, I mean, it's definitely something that on paper we would enjoy, because I think, I mean, I know you're a fan of slice of life stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of like metaphysical bullshit. Like, there's stuff in it that like should hit our buttons, but at the same time, I did feel a little underwhelmed, I guess.
Yeah,
like, it didn't feel like it was like my worldview has not changed.
Yeah,
you know,
I was telling Marvin earlier before we started recording that Murakami is kind of like the literature version of David Lynch, the director and creator of Twin Peaks. And I really don't like Twin Peaks. So it's just like, I get why David Lynch is like really, really celebrated and why people love Twin Peaks. I mean, Dan and some of my close friends, they really, really love Twin Peaks.
Mm.
So it's like, I'm not one of those people, and I'm probably never gonna really be a fan of Murakami, I think. But I am curious to read his other books, and I will give him a shot before I close that door forever.
and going out there, I think I am one of those people who, like, I haven't seen a lot of Twin Peaks. I watched the first couple episodes, and I kind of just fell off because...
I heard that you have to get past like the first 5 episodes to like really get into it.
But I do get the fact that like it's the type of story where you want to, after you finish it, you want to read other people's reactions to it and to see, catch the things that you missed and see what people think everything meant. Because like you said, like we've said multiple times in this podcast, everything's a metaphor for something. Everything means something. Like it's a book full of Chekhov's guns. Like he's just showing barrels left and right. Like, which of these will fire? They all will, but will you catch it? And like, it's a type of thing. Like, because I'm the type of person who will fall down a wiki hole on like TVTropes.com and just read about everything that people are thinking about everything. And so it's not. I don't know if it's healthy or not, but it's.
I think it's useful
yeah.
for you know, analyzing things.
It's good for trivia because now I know a bunch of useless bullshit. So I'm like, if anyone ever needs a trivia partner, I'm your guy.
With that said, this month's book club pick is Zero Sum Game by S.L. Huang. It's a thriller, and it's going to be quite different from Murakami, and I'm very excited. I just bought the book on Amazon. It's on my ebook, so I am really excited to dive into it.
Yeah, looking forward to it. We'll be talking about Zero Sum Game on our next episode of Books and Boba at the end of the month. Thank you all so much for joining us and listening to our discussion of our very first Murakami book, Kafka on the Shore. I guess, you know, it'll probably be a couple months or a year until we assign our next one, if we do. But
is this going to be an every year thing? I feel like Murakami publishes his books fairly often. I feel like we'll never catch up.
I don't think we're going to read his whole like catalog of books, but I think I kind of feel like if we don't assign it as a book later on, I'll never read another one. So I kind of need to I need the push, Rira, is what I need.
I know. I totally would not have finished this book unless I had to for this podcast.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like it's worth seeing, especially if this book, like people say, is kind of an outlier in terms of characters. I kind of want to see what another story might look like. So I feel like chances are high that we'll read another one eventually, just not for a while.
Not for a while. I think my brain really needs to recover.
Yeah. But thank you all for listening. Rira, thank you for joining me in this. It was fun talking about it, you know?
That's right? True. If you read this book by yourself, I feel like you would kind of be itching to talk to it with someone.
Yeah.
Either like someone who's never read it and you're like trying to describe this book to them. I feel like it's really hard to describe Murakami books to people because I've definitely had people try to like get me to read Murakami for years. And I'm like, I don't understand anything that you're saying about this book to me.
Well, it's like someone trying to explain, I don't know, a Persona game to someone. Or
no, I feel like that's really simplistic.
Have you tried explaining it to someone?
Yeah.
Like a normal layman person?
Teens with magical powers with magical demon cards. They go into different worlds and they have to save everybody. That is the most simplistic terms that you can,
I guess. I guess without going to the Jungian psychology and all that jazz.
It's like what Murakami says in Kafka on the Shore. You don't know until you experience it.
And with that, thank you all for listening to this episode of Books and Boba. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts. Check out our other fellow Potluck pods by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. And thanks also to Visual Communications. This podcast was recorded at the VC offices in downtown LA. Check out their programs such as the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival at vcmedia.org. And as always, you can find us at booksandboba.com. And don't forget to join our Goodreads group to chat with us about book news, your thoughts about the books that we read, and to let us know what's going on in your world.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Bye, everyone.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.